My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential. Welcome to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. It's Jeff Lerner, your host. Always thrilled to be back with you, getting to have amazing conversations with amazing human beings. Today, I am joined by actually a good friend of mine, Mr. Larry Yatch, 10-year veteran of the U.S. Navy SEALs, somebody who led and planned over 200 missions for the SEALs. I'm sure he has some exciting, actually, I know for a fact because we're friends and I've heard some of them, but some exciting, very literal war stories. But now he works in the professional world, essentially reverse engineering the processes, mindsets, and systems that the SEALs use to be among the, you know, or maybe the most effective teams in the world, and applying them to business. And also specifically, which is the capacity that I met him, helping unlock the performance potential of business leaders, CEOs, founders, entrepreneurs, et cetera. An expert on building teams, the author of How Leadership Actually Works, and a dear friend of mine, Mr. Larry Yatch. Welcome to Unlock Your Potential.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here.
So glad you're here. And, you know, it's always interesting. Gosh, I think this is like episode number 200 and it's the early 200s that we've recorded. And I would say maybe 10 times now it's been bringing on like a dear old friend. Right.
Yeah.
And those are always interesting conversations because I try not to just lead us into a casual stroll of catching up and really stay focused on value for the audience. But I am excited to catch up. And I know you've been up to a lot of cool things in the last, I'm trying to think, when's the last time we were really like physically shared space? Has it been 2 years?
It's over a year. So it's probably just over a year.
Okay. So
I remember we had a conversation. The last time we talked was on the phone. I was in Fruta, Colorado on a mountain bike trip. Cause I remember being at that house talking to you.
And I'm trying to think where I was. I was not at home. I was in.
It was June of last year. So it's okay. Like almost exactly a year ago, we were on the phone and we had seen each other like a month before that.
And I think for high performance, you know, entrepreneurs, we're kind of like, I think we're like the inverse of dogs. Like a dog, like 1 year is like 7 years. I think for us, like 1 year is like a seventh of a year.
Or, yeah, I don't know. I'm with you.
Maybe we are dogs. I'm not sure if we're dogs or dogs inverted.
Yeah, either way. 1 year is what? Like
it's like a lifetime.
3 months. It feels like it's been 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, yeah. But at the same time, we've probably crammed a decade worth of change into the last year. So
that is for damn sure.
So that's it. Why don't we set the context then? You can catch me up by proxy, but for purposes of the audience, set me up now to understand like what is it that you do every day? What do you go to work at?
I'm actually in a massive change. Like, I don't know as of the next couple of weeks, it's completely changing. So, my business evolution, when it comes to what we've done for the last now 8-9 years has been in, I would say performance, but really team performance. Right. So yes, I've worked on like with you individual performance, that's why it was when I saw the title of the show on my calendar, I was like, oh, this would be good. Unlocking the potential, right? Mm-hmm. For me, we do some of that, as you know, some of that work with individuals, but only based on the need to unlock the potential of their team based on them being a limiter of it.
Yeah.
Right. So it's really performance, but performance very, very much focused on teams and coordination of action with those teams. So that's what we've been doing for 8-9 years at this point. The evolution of our business was from that of products into a service into now partnerships. So we started where we would provide services to companies. Initially big companies, right? So companies that were minimum of 30, 40 million a year, but the sweet spot was a couple hundred million a year. And it was working with management, their management from senior management down to into the trenches management in just leadership development. And it was product based. And then we shifted into taking those same systems to apply to entrepreneurial levels, right? From really 3 million up in yearly revenue. And then about 2 years ago, we started switching into services, where as opposed to an individual class or course or workshop or coaching engagement, it was providing holistic services for the entire organization on a repetitive basis, a retainer type basis. And then over the last year, last 6 months, we've been seeing as the potential of the teams was unlocked and they started gaining momentum, the biggest limitation was in the management of the organization. And so we've started moving into now taking over managerial responsibilities or positional authority within the partner companies we work with while still up-leveling their team. So I don't know, like we've been turning off a bunch of, that means no more sales and marketing.
Right.
And now it's just much deeper work. So my calendar is oddly open for the next couple of weeks.
Interesting. So, you know, as I guess you sort of alluded to the context in which you and I got connected, I was speaking at a mastermind that I also was attending. You were a speaker there. You shared your story. What I really, really connected with you on, and what I think is a huge sort of like core precept for the audience is it was essentially an unpacking of what I might refer to as like John Maxwell's law of the lid, right? That like, ultimately your leadership ability is the singular constraint of the growth potential of not only yourself, your business, your team, the people you support, the people that you lead, you know, that ultimately it all comes back to us, right? When we're trying to do big things in the world. And it sounds like, and by the way, as an aside, not to try to say two things at once, but I also think that evolution for you of products to services to partnerships, that probably, and I'm curious to hear your comments on how naturally that's happened, but I think that represents a very natural growth curve for what I'll call people in the information or knowledge business, people that are operationalizing what they know that someone else wants to know, that's kind of how it goes, right? Like you start by selling an accessible product, then people get results and they want more of you. They want you to do some stuff for them. And then eventually they realize there's more, the deeper they can go with you, the more upside they unlock. And they're like, screw it. Let's go from a retainer to a partnership. Like that feels, I think I've heard that before. I know I've heard that before. Is that just kind of how it happened?
I wish I would have known that model ahead of time. Would have saved me a whole lot of what are we going to do next? What's funny is in the rearview mirror, it makes total sense,
right?
Like you're saying, it makes absolute sense that that's how it would progress. I didn't set out with that intention, right? It was always getting to the next kind of inflection point. And for me, it's always been in results. Like, how do I get more results, more impact on our clients? And that's where I saw, well, a one-time product doesn't get enough results. I got to get with them longer. So I'd have to move them into a retainer base, like where we get to do consistent work over time. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we fixed all their problems, yet the company was limited by the management. And so then that became the next piece of how do I create more impact with them? Well, we need to start taking over some managerial responsibilities.
So we've probably just touched on a huge value piece within this. You know, I'm always sort of scanning in real time the conversational environment. Like, what are they going to be the big takeaways for the audience? And given that a lot of the audience is entrepreneurial inside the information economy, I think we've probably just touched on something really valuable that, like you just said, if you'd known it ahead of time, it would have, whether it would have accelerated or not, it might have decreased a lot of anxiety around it. That, you know, for those of you out there that have knowledge that you want to operationalize in the form of a business, like this is how it goes. Your MVP is like, how do I package it? Because frankly, when you're not built to fulfill services, like services at scale are a lot harder to fulfill than digital products at scale, right? Yeah. So you start with a digital product because you know you can scale that without drowning yourself in a fulfillment burden. But as you get better at it and you produce better results with it and create a better product, your MVP you know, of a product, this is just kind of, there's inevitability to this if you're really, really good at what you do. And that's a big if, right? Like if you're not, nobody's going to want to hire you to do the stuff that your course taught. But anyway, so that's just for everybody else to like take another comfort in that. This is how the knowledge business goes, right?
Yeah. Another piece to this that I think if we're highlighting value, another piece of this, and I've found this to be a role in a couple different areas. I think it's just a fundamental principle. You can't jump the curve, right? Like you can't, I know I've failed many times in business endeavors by trying to go to partnership before I had perfected service, before I perfected product, right? So I don't think you can jump. Like, I don't think you can start a partnership.
Yeah. And by the way, let me back that up even further, because I heard some pretty funny stuff. Somebody was talking to Tom Bilyeu about this, you know, Tom Bilyeu from Impact Theory and the guy that started Quest Nutrition. Somebody was talking to him about that. And they were like, yeah, this guy was saying that he's just like Tom Bilyeu. And I'm like, this was the guy that was talking to Tom. And they were like saying, they're like, yeah, I sized him up. And I was like, yeah, you kind of are like Tom. Just minus the whole Quest Nutrition thing, minus the whole like, oh, I built a $1 billion company, now I have credibility thing, right? Yeah. And like, you can't skip that step either, which for you, it was 10 years in the SEALs.
Yeah.
And so you don't even get to start at product, you have to start at actually doing something that matters.
Yeah, highly, the thing that I'd learned in a graduate business course that I had was a highly valued accomplishment. If you don't have a highly valued accomplishment, that's the ticket price to get in the door.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting. God, even for myself, God, I swear all knowledge is valuable, but it's also frustrating because of the opportunity cost of not having known it sooner. Yeah. You learn it and there's a, yes, I learned it. And then also a shit, why didn't I learn that 10 years ago? And for me, even, you know, the highly valued, what'd you call it? A highly valued accomplishment.
Highly valued accomplishment.
Yeah. So for me, it was like, what was my highly valued accomplishment that qualified me to go out in the world and talk about being an entrepreneur in the modern economy? It was like, well, I scaled an agency, you know, I made multiple millions of dollars, not like billions, but like, you know, more money than most people do and as much as most people want. But the cool thing was I did it from home around a lifestyle. And that was, but what I found is even in getting into the entrepreneurial education space, that accomplishment by itself was not actually highly valued enough. The thing that has really, really unlocked a lot of doors for me has been building a top 100 business podcast
and writing
a book.
Yeah.
Even just those things I can feel have created like an upward gravity in my life that you're totally right. Like, to a large degree in business, and this is like a brutally tough pill to swallow, it is very hard to outperform that which you have, the meaning of the thing you've already done in the past.
I gotta unpack that one.
Oh yeah, and I said it like unconsidered. So let's see, is that true? It's actually
hard to outperform that which you've produced value in the past.
Yeah, like if you're gonna go into like the thought leadership space at least.
I mean, that's where as soon as you're in the space of trying to get someone's attention, then there is no other way.
Yes. Right?
Like, there is no other way. Like, that's part of the reason why it's interesting. I've always been hesitant to leverage the SEAL accomplishment, that highly valued accomplishment, to get attention, which is why I've always had a limited exposure. Mm-hmm. Like, I could, like, if I really wanted to double down on the SEAL brand and have that be the focus of who I am, then I could have gotten a ton of attention and then leverage that attention where I wanted. I've never wanted to do that. And so in doing that, I've limited the amount of attention that I can get from the public.
Yeah. So it's interesting. You're the fourth former Navy SEAL that I've had on the show. Gosh, I say that. And then, so there's Clint Emerson, Jason Redmond.
Clint and I were in we went to war together.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, we went to Iraq together.
Clint's been on the show. Jason Redmond.
Yep.
I'm totally blanking on the first one. Oh my gosh, it's like actually embarrassing. If I hadn't said it, it would come to mind. But anyways, but you're right. You're the one who I think is the least Navy SEAL-ish about yourself, so to speak.
Oh, totally. And my public appearance is the least, right? Like when it comes to SEAL, it's very lack of connected. And arguably, I believe that the work that I've done post SEALs is much more important than the work that I did as a SEAL. Because part of people often ask, what's the difference between, you know, the content that we have and Jocko's content? Well, big difference is what I'm putting out is based on the 13 years of entrepreneurship after the SEALs, not the 10 years in the SEALs. All of their content is based on the time they spend in the SEALs, now applying it to entrepreneurship. It's two different. It's a very different direction to go at.
So, okay, that raises a great question. Like we're going to look at, because there is, I mean, there's this sort of, you know, and let's face it, modern culture is sort of like got this love affair with the SEALs. I mean, basically, I actually applaud you on your discipline and your restraint of not just marching out into the world and being I'm Larry Yatch, former Navy SEAL badass. So like hire me, because a lot of people would.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So looking at it, looking at the negative space, what would you say? I've literally don't think of all the, you know, I've heard all the, many conversations with Jocko and Leif Babin and, you know, Goggins and all these people with their military kind of pedigrees. Where is it that it does not map over? Like, what would you say are some integral principles in the SEAL teams that actually don't translate to business? Nobody ever talks about that.
Yeah. So I don't know. This might be.
I mean, other than like, if you don't agree with somebody, you can kill them. Like, I think that does.
Yeah. You can use high explosives to solve any problem you have. Right. I don't know how this will be taken in for the bigger audience, but like, I have a very strong opinion on this. There is a reliance on individual performance that allows the SEALs to work the way they do. So if you look at a lot of the content that you're going to get from Goggins or Jocko, Leif, there is a reliance on the individual to perform at a certain level for it to work, right? Think of it. Extreme individual ownership responsibility. Like that's
so it's like, so you're saying it's a team that's predicated on having a bunch of individual superstars that are also willing to subordinate their individual superstardom.
You got it.
It's still a prerequisite.
Goggins, like just, I am a hard ass. Like I can do anything. You can be like me if you just work really, really, really hard and suffer really, really good. So that all works, right? It does. And arguably what I love, like a distinction I make between Jocko and Leif stuff and ours is they're really talking about individual leadership, right? They're teaching you how to individually become a better leader. Very needed, right? Mm-hmm. Awesome stuff. Within that becomes a need for individual self-regulation, responsibility, discipline. David, same thing, right? That's the message. It's individual leadership. Where we focus on is the structures necessary for a team to coordinate well. And if you rely on individual leadership, individual discipline, individual performance to leverage or produce a high functioning team, it won't work, right? You get limited. You're limited because that's the biggest argument. Go do extreme ownership and then try and put it into a company where people are mediocre to poor performers. It won't work.
Which is, and I'm curious to the extent to which you agree with this, but like, you know, and I say this respectfully, knowing some of my own employees will hear this, but like in most companies, most employees are not exceptional.
They can't be, or they would be in your position.
Yeah. They'd be the exception, which means they couldn't be the norm. Yeah. Okay.
Right. And so that is why I love it is it's not only the gap, but it's the answer to the gap. Right. So we need what they're saying and doing. because we need to up level individual performance and individual leadership. We also need to know how teams function and to coordinate action on teams that are not necessarily high functioning individuals, because that's the reality in which all of us that are not in the SEALs are going to operate in.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we need both. That's why I in no way, shape or form am putting down what they're saying, but I'm saying there is a gap in ultimate high performance because you can't have everyone be amazing. You can't hire everyone to be amazing, or else you're spending way too much money and your pool of us people is too limited. And so it's like a 1-2 punch. Right. And you can do, like, I can start with a jab cross, or I can do cross jab. Like, you can go either way.
Right.
You can up level individual leadership and then work on now coordinating action as a team, or you can up level how you coordinate action, which provides space to increase individual leadership. Right. If I was to say which way to go, like, I would always go with coordination of action first, individual leadership second, based on the fact that we're going to get more early wins by getting teams functioning better at the individual level they're at. And then once we have that space, now let's make everyone better.
Well, and I can't help but think too, that the more you can coordinate, you know, team action and let's say the more you can align variables that aren't individual in nature, the more you diminish and to some degree call out the ego of the person that wants it to make it about the quality of the people around them.
Yeah.
Like there's nowhere to hide. Once your team is operating in a highly coordinated fashion, you as the leader can't blame them for the lack of progress anymore.
Yeah. But right? If you're surrounded by idiots, guess what? You're the idiot.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. So let's talk. I guess maybe sort of sidestep into the same conversation from a different direction. You and I have talked a lot, and I know we've done some work together and a lot of work independently around trauma.
Yeah.
Healing trauma, growing from trauma, learning from trauma, blah, blah, blah. I know you did an interview with my mastermind. I feel like we've had a couple of these conversations. I don't know. I guess the details don't matter, but
yeah, it was with the mastermind group.
Okay. So can you unpack, cause I'll say the thing, like when Larry Yatch had me, so to speak, like, okay, I was like, okay, I'm going to go talk to this guy. I want this guy in my world, was when you basically made the statement and then built the logical proof that the growth of any organization will ultimately become capped at the trauma of its leader. And I might be misstating that, but
you got it really close.
Okay. Can you talk more about, cause I mean, again, there's a lot of people in this audience that are solopreneurs or early stage team builders, people with big, big ambitions, and to challenge every single one of us, myself included, and say, look, your organization is never going to outperform your own trauma and the extent to which you've dealt with it. That's like a provocative statement that I'm hoping you'll lean into for me.
Right. So the statement that I caught you with is that the growth of a structurally sound organization, and that's a key piece.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
If you do not have a structurally sound, if you don't have an offer, you don't have all the parts of a business, all that stuff, your growth is limited by that. Right.
Right.
For sure. But once you have a structurally sound organization, and this doesn't have to be big, right? This can be one person with, you know, marketing, sales, fulfillment, support. You know, we got all four of those parts and they're working at some level. So don't hear organization and rule yourself out because you're one or two person company. It doesn't matter. So if you have a structurally sound company, meaning you got all the parts of a company, you have an offer that therefore you have an offer that's working.
So like, I mean, just to contextualize this, you could be like a one person, one chair barber with a barbershop.
100%. Right. So
Okay. How
do I assess this structural sound? Four parts: marketing, sales, fulfillment, and support. So Marketing is from someone gaining interest to when they ask you for something, then it goes into sales. from asking for it to giving you a dollar of sales. Once they give you a dollar bill, you've made a promise. Fulfillment's fulfilling on the promise you made them for the dollar. And support are all the things that aren't getting a client or servicing that client that you have to do your job.
Right.
Right. So being a solo barber in a barber seat has to attract attention, get someone to ask for a haircut, promise them that they're going to give them a haircut, collect a dollar for it, and then give them the haircut. And then clean up, make sure they've got scissors and right. clean up the hair after, right? Like it doesn't matter. Those four things are important. So one person can do that or multiple people.
Mm-hmm.
This, I'd love to take can I take a sidetrack from this? Cause I think you'll find this to be very, very interesting. And this, I guess, would be one of the biggest insights that I've made in the last 2 or 3 years about the structural integrity of an organization. Like this was can be a game changer. So when assessing the structural stability or soundness of an organization, the first thing we're looking at are those four parts. Like, do they exist? And then the next thing is at what level are we acting or fulfilling each of those four parts, right? Some organizations really strong on marketing, not good at sales,
mm-hmm.
or really good at marketing and sales, not so good at fulfillment, or those might be all good and support's not good. So what we found, and this to be really interesting, is when you look at those four parts of your business, it isn't the level to which you're performing in those, it's the relative level.
Yeah.
When one of those is higher or lower than the others, we have problems. If we're
is that the delta? Isn't that the
technical delta, term? Like if I'm at 3 on marketing, 3 on sales, 3 on fulfillment, 3 on support, I'm actually doing okay. If I'm at 7, 8 on marketing, 9 on sales, 2 on fulfillment, 9 on support, I'm in trouble. And so that was a huge game changer of, wow, I'm not just trying to increase my performance on every level. I'm trying to normalize or equalize my performance and then strategically grow them opposed to just being really good at marketing.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I feel like a lot of like team theory and like team, you know, teaching around teams is around like feeding your winners, playing to your strengths, like taking your, like doubling down on the things you're already good at. But it sounds like holistically across an organization, and I've experienced this, so it rings true, that can actually compound problems if you make your strong points stronger without showing up your weaknesses. Hey there, sorry to interrupt the show, but I just have a quick favor to ask. So we recently broke into the top 100 podcasts in the entrepreneurship category. We've been hovering around 75 and we're really trying to push up into like the top 20 and grow the impact of the show. So if you enjoy what we do here and you're a supporter, the biggest thing you could do to help would be to leave us a positive review. Whatever platform you're listening on, you should be able to leave a quick review, let the world know what you like about the show. Thank you so much for your time and let's get back to it.
Yeah, it's crazy to like, we've been working with companies. We do what we call business health assessment, where we're really looking at, we're not only looking at those four things, we're looking at the handoffs between them.
Yeah.
And we're looking at the impacts from them. So we do it deeply, but when we go to a company, like we're gonna tell you, you're gonna cut your marketing budget by 50% this time. Like, what are you talking about? We finally got it working. Well, if you keep doing that, you're gonna collapse your business because your fulfillment can't keep up with it. Or we have to reduce your sales goals. Like they can't believe it.
Yeah.
Their strength in those are causing all their problems in the company. And so we have to pull down the high ones first to get them equal. And then we can start building them up. But that just that concept of not looking at trying to increase performance no matter what, actually looking at relative performance between those domains and normalizing them, that's a game changer for looking at how to assess your business.
So knowing that this selfish question, because I would say that I've gone through the last, like my company hit a $50 million annualized run rate about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
And we have, to some degree, by design, not budged for 18 months. Because of exactly what you're saying, where we realized we were way better at sales and marketing than we were at fulfillment and administration. Yeah. And I think we're just getting to the point where we have pretty well normalized. But I'm curious, knowing that not everything's going to grow equally at once, how much do you have any sort of formulas for how much you can grow one thing or allow one thing to exceed the relative range of the others before it becomes problematic and you have to switch focus to bringing up the laggards?
So the way that I describe it is you actually did the right thing, right? Normalize first, right?
Yeah. And we realized, I mean, we didn't do it because we were smart. We did it because we were desperate. We were going to collapse the weight.
You're going to break stuff. Good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, okay, so I'm a little less impressed by you because I was like,
yeah, don't be too impressed, Larry.
Yeah, sorry. I was like, damn, normally we're the ones that have to tell people to do this. Usually what happens is they're going to break, right?
And yeah, we enrolled almost 100,000 students in a year.
Yeah.
Because here's the thing, COVID happened.
Yeah.
And we're an online entrepreneurial education company and 40 million people got sent home to go online and look for ways to make money. And we're like, bull. And we had just gotten our offer dialed in. So anyway, that's our story. That doesn't matter. But yeah, keep going. And I'm asking selfishly to know, okay, now that we're ready for the next wave of growth, how much can we push on sales and marketing before we risk breaking the other areas again?
Okay. So here's how it goes. The first thing is equalize what you did by necessity, which is good. The next thing is strategizing growth. So when people think or they hear strategized growth, they think, how do I get more clients? That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about from those four, what we call levers, right? Marketing set or lead gen marketing is a lever. Sales is a lever. Fulfillment's a level. Support's a lever. Looking at it and strategically designing, what am I going to grow first? Right? You immediately went to growth is marketing and sales. No, maybe I want to grow fulfillment first. Right? So what does it look like if I grow fulfillment first? What would I have to do?
You're saying even growing fulfillment beyond your current level of marketing and sales to where you have better products and more capacity to deliver them than you're currently demanding from yourself.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah.
And so that's an investment in the company, right?
That's long game thinking right there.
This is all long game thinking,
yeah.
Right? And at the game, at the size you're playing, you got to play a long game.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to, if you're just dialing in an offer and you're small, maybe all you got to do is until you start pushing higher volume, I can't do anything else. But I would say like, the even longer game is support. Right? Because support's always the redheaded stepchild.
Yeah, which right? we call what you're calling support, we call business services. It's essentially the skeletal and nervous systems of your operation.
Right. And so what am I going to grow? So again, I'm not executing growth yet. All I'm doing is strategizing. So, okay, I'm going to grow fulfillment first. What does that look like? What's it going to cost? And what the next piece of it is contingencies. What that's going to break something. So why I identify those contingencies next, like if I raise that level up to two notches and the other ones stay low, what problems are going to show up?
Yeah.
And how do I avoid, mitigate and back up for those problems now? So what do I put in place to make sure that I avoid those problems? I make it so they don't hurt when they inevitably show up. And if I miss something, what's my backup plan? So I'm going to put that in place first and execute that increase with those contingencies. Then at that point, the next thing, all I'm doing is I'm going to be solving the problems to increase the other ones to match now equalize again. So I'm equalizing in the new norm and I go right back into strategic growth.
So, and I don't want to turn this in, although I have been known to do this on this show, I'm not going to turn this into free consulting for myself. But I just want to make sure I'm not at all saying I'm above that. I just right now I have other things I want to ask you. But I will say, just as an example of kind of what you're saying, instead of us going, all right, let's up our marketing spend by 50%, you know, max out the whole ecosystem to where it's about to burst again, and then scramble to put in more fulfillment, more products, more delivery of those products, more backend support, more tech, blah, 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 that we could take the approach to say, all right, we're going to, and we are doing this with tech, like let's say we have, you know, at any given time active, I don't even know the number, but let's say we have 50,000 active users of our platform at any given time. We're going to go ahead and invest in a technological foundation to have, you know, to be able to support 250,000 active users at a time. And we're going to invest in the cybersecurity requirements to be able to protect 250,000 users at a time across all the devices and ISPs and whatever, all the nodes. We're going to go ahead and have the coaching capacity and the event capacity and the curriculum training capacity and all this. And in other words, we're going to create the inverse problem, which is, holy crap, if we don't actually go spend more money and acquire more customers and generate more revenue, we're going to teeter over because we're too top heavy with fulfillment capacity.
Yeah. And so I would say my suggestion, if we weren't making this a consulting call, would be, what does it look like to increase, like, this is where you get strategic. Like, do I have to go from 50,000 to 250, or do I go from 50,000 to 125?
Right.
And so it doesn't hurt that bad, but we start to create that momentum. The other thing I would say is you would want a metric. Like, how do I know when I'm at that, right? Like my overall capacity for the fulfillment team should be, they should be asking, they should be hungry. And then
if their loads get too light, you know, they'll go find other work.
Exactly. And so that's where I might not take that big of a jump in capacity. It's take a smaller jump. And then as soon, really, you're getting that one in the momentum of moving that way. And then it's like, okay, now we're going. That's why this business health assessment, it's done like at the worst quarterly, right? But like almost, if you're in this type of thing, you'd be doing it monthly. Like, okay, where are my levers? Where am I at? Okay, we just bumped this one up. Have we met it? How do we know that we've got fulfillment from 6 to 7? Okay, right. We're now at 7. Where are things breaking? Okay, we're going to start jumping in. Marketing's next. Marketing bumps up. Hey, we know sales issues are going to come up next because our sales team's not ready for that next piece. What do we need to avoid, mitigate, back up on the sales department as the marketing starts to hit? Right. So it becomes that type of a conversation.
Yeah. And I think you're really touching on one of the reasons why healthy growth doesn't proceed faster than it can healthily proceed, so to speak, which is taking the time. You know, for example, in what you just described, there's really two critical things that are pretty time consuming and intensive of at least intellectual capital, if not money capital. But they're like, otherwise you're at risk of, you know, immolation, which is a breakpoint analysis, like from 50, what is the next logical breakpoint? Is it 50 to 125? Is it 50 to 250? Is it 50 to 100? Right. And not just like pulling a number out of the air for whatever the KPI is. And then secondly, actually creating the dashboards or the real-time business intelligence or the feedback mechanisms, whatever they are, to be able to give you the data to do that monthly health check, or as close to real-time as possible. So that you're not like performing surgery on your business without knowing the patient's blood pressure.
And what's an interesting thing that you put there is I've gone the route, like, because I'm a nerd, right? For sure. Like core through, I'm a nerd and I love numbers and spreadsheets. And I'd rather not talk to anyone, right? Like if it was.
Right. This is one of the reasons Larry and I get along.
About yeah, that. Totally. There's like 5 people I want to talk to. You're one of them because you're a nerd too. And we can talk numbers. So that piece is like, that's my tendency is to go that route. Like you just said, dashboards, digital, full-time, all that stuff. What I've been finding to be more effective is objective, subjective and group objective, subjective, right? So what I mean by objective, subjective, like numbers are completely objective. There's no subjectivity to them. How you assess the numbers is where some subjectivity comes into it. I don't care if it's interesting. Say we're both in your business and we do this health assessment and you rank, OK, because you rank sales at 5 and I rank sales at 8. We're not going off of specific numbers. Like right. We're not going off a metric. The computer's not telling us it's 5 or 8. Just the fact that you think it's 5 and I think it's 8, that conversation is massive.
Yeah.
Right. And then from there is like, why do I think it's 8? Why do you think it's 5? So that what we've been finding is instead of going totally objective with numbers, going subjective with multiple people gives you a better picture and better conversation. So I've actually gone more on the route of softer questions, but a number of them versus straight numbers.
So really, essentially just making sure that at least some reasonable percentage of your data inputs are subjective people-based inputs, not just what your system
becomes important.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, cool. So, all right. Like I said, I'm not going to let us go any further down the free consulting rabbit hole, although I'm grateful always.
So we're going back to, let me go back to what you were asking about how trauma limits growth.
Yes.
I had said, well, before we can even talk about trauma limiting growth, you need a structurally sound company. We said structural soundness, the way I look at it is 4 domains: marketing, sales, fulfillment, support. And then the insight that I had recently, I want to share with you, is that, wow, it doesn't matter the number. It matters how they are relative to each other. Huge insights. Then we went down a rabbit hole. So going back to the original thing, in a structurally sound organization, the unresolved traumas of the CEO or the head of it is the biggest limitation to growth. That's the statement that I made. And where that usually triggers people is that the vast majority of people that I say that to immediately have the same response as I imagine most of the people on this that are listening. Well, I haven't experienced any trauma.
Yeah.
Right. And therein lies the trap, right? The biggest trap I think that we've created for ourselves is the connection of trauma to big life event.
Well, yeah, as a culture, we've almost celebritized trauma.
Yeah.
There's like your celebrity traumas. There's like your rape. There's like your child molestation. There's like a family member was murdered in front of me in a, you know, tribal war. And you know what I mean? Like we've created like these big 5 traumas.
Yeah. And if you haven't experienced one of those, then you haven't experienced trauma.
You're a trauma poser, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now where I went in a different door for that is, What is the common thread between war, rape, loss of a loved one, massive accident, you know, where you're injured? What is the common thread between what are very different things? And the common thread that I found is a perceived loss of control, right? And that then opens everything up, right? War and rape are the same in that in war, it's only traumatizing when I perceive that I don't control the outcome. Right.
And is that relative? Meaning there are greater or lesser perceived losses of control that correlate to greater or lesser traumas.
Right. So if you were to take the rate of a drafted army infantry soldier in Vietnam, right? So take that group of people and you take the Navy SEALs that went to Vietnam. If you looked at the average exposure to danger, conflict, war, fights, all that stuff, the SEALs much higher, right? They were just in horrible stuff all the time.
Right.
You know, some Army guys, yes, but overall, right, it's a lower level. If you look at the rate of post-traumatic stress from a drafted infantry guy versus a Navy SEAL.
Key term drafted, meaning did not sign up for it.
Drafted versus a Navy SEAL, the instances and depth of the post-traumatic stress would be not even comparable, right? On the Army side, massive. On the SEAL side, very, very small. How could that be? It is an exposure to risk that caused the trauma. It is the perception of control within that risk that causes the trauma. right? So a drafted guy, as soon as he's drafted, he is now fertile ground for trauma. He doesn't even want to be in the Army.
Well, he's probably, yeah, he's already traumatized just because he got drafted.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So he doesn't want to be in the Army. Then they put him through minimal training, so he's got no real perception of skill or control, ability to influence his outcome. They give him no information on what he's doing, where he's going, what missions he's on. He's just go stand here and point your gun in that direction, right? That is absolute perception and no control of the outcome. Navy SEAL had to fight through the hardest training process in the world just to become a SEAL. Then would actually argue with each other as to who gets to go to war. And then in that has 3 years of training in doing it with a group of guys that he trusts his life with more than ever, and then anyone anywhere, and then is part of the planning process for all the missions that goes on, right? Perception and control is up here.
Yeah.
So it's perception and control that causes trauma, not exposure to what would be a traumatic environment. And that all goes back to us being cave people. As a cave person, every time I was exposed to an environment where I didn't control something, if the weather changed, I die. If the deer go to the other field, I die. If I get a scratch on a branch, I die. So as a cave person for 200,000 years, we're conditioned to know if we don't control something, we're going to die. That's why you can take someone that is scared of public speaking, put them in front of 10 people, and they will act physiologically and neurochemically as if they're going to die when there's absolutely no risk, all based on perceived lack of control. I want to underline the point, everyone that's listening to this show has experienced trauma, even if you've never been to war, been raped, had a massive accident, injury, life event. That's the first important thing. Every single one of us has lived in a world where we had a perception that we didn't control outcome, especially as a child.
Yeah, I remember you talking to me in one of our conversations about the different things that, like you said, physiologically mirror war or attack, you know, more violent physical trauma. Like as a kid, like you were like, you know, another kid calls you stupid, and like physiologically you respond exactly the same way you would if a guy pointed a gun at your face.
It makes no difference. And yeah, as a child, because we know that we can't survive without our parents, without those around us, it doesn't take much for us to feel like our life is at risk if we get any sort of isolation, right? Any sort of isolation, any sort of disconnection from those we care of. Parents that either are bad parents or just made the wrong choice, it doesn't make a difference, right? One of the examples, the seed trauma, the core trauma for this guy that he had to deal with for the rest of his life, caused himself all sorts of trouble, was when he was about 3.5, 4, he remembers having a massive outburst. Like, he was just yelling and crying like a tantrum. And his parents put him in his room for about 15 minutes and then came in and talked to him. Like, that's what good parents do. For a three-year-old, they have no perception of time. Time doesn't exist yet. You take a three-year-old in already a triggered state, put him in a room by themselves, that child now believes, can go down the road of they are going to die because they've been isolated from their caregivers. And a child that is isolated from their caregivers at 3 years old doesn't have any concept they're going to come back.
Yeah.
So think about that. This poor guy, seed trauma was something that his parents did that was right. Like, it was a good behavior.
Right.
That you'd call like good parenting. So my point in bringing that up is not to have you worry that, holy crap, I'm traumatizing my kids. Yes, you are. It's okay. What I'm bringing that up is all it takes is a perception when you're pre-logical at 3 years old that you don't control something and you now have experienced trauma.
So basically trauma is in the eye of the beholder to a large degree.
Yes. And it is the mechanism through which adults develop, right? So we have all been traumatized. That is an important point, because everything I say from now on out depends on the listener actually saying like, he's talking to me. Because that's what I have to get over the most, especially entrepreneurs, because they're masters of their world, right? Or we wouldn't be an entrepreneur. So they're always like, well, I've never had trauma. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking to you. Yes, I'm talking to you. You have experienced trauma. These all things line up. The the mechanism for problem is understanding that trauma is merely a lesson, right? We mix traumatic experience, traumatic environment, trauma into one thing.
Traumatic experience, traumatic environment, and trauma itself.
Those are the three very different things, right?
Ooh, so that sounds deep. Can you unpack that?
So traumatic experience is any environment where I have a perception I don't control the outcome. The more perceived consequence, the deeper the trauma. So not all traumas are equal, right? If I have a perception that I have no control and there's massive consequence to not having control, big trauma.
Okay.
If I have a perception that I don't have a lot of control, but there's little consequence, little trauma. But either way, trauma is developed. So trauma is the experience, like when I perceive I don't have control, there's consequence. The environment is the environment in which that experience happened. If in my traumatic experience, I die because I had no control, I don't experience trauma. Right? That's an important piece, right? I only experience trauma if I survive.
Okay.
So trauma is the lesson that I learned in surviving the traumatic experience.
Okay.
Now, trauma is good when that lesson serves us. It always serves us in the same environment. So when I was in war and I experienced trauma, I learned lessons in war that served me in war. When I am no longer in war, and I'm using the same lessons, I create stress in my life. That's post-traumatic stress.
So post-traumatic stress is to some degree the legitimate application of lessons learned, only in the wrong environment.
You nailed it. Right. So for example, in war, I learned that everything could go to shit at any point in time. Like that was true. I didn't make that up. Planes crashed. Helicopters caught fire.
And in fact, that belief probably kept you safe and had you planning appropriately.
Well, on top of it, I learned that if something went to crap, people I cared about and loved were going to get hurt. And because I was an officer, I knew that if they got hurt, it was my fault. So I lived in the truth that everything was going to go to crap, that everyone I cared about was going to get hurt, and it was all my fault. That made me an excellent SEAL in a wartime environment, right? Excellent. Served me. That was true. And it worked well. Starting a business in which I know everything's going to go to crap, everyone I'm responsible for is going to suffer, and it's all my fault, made for a miserable life of suffering and a limited business because it is no longer the same environment. So I created stress by being hypervigilant in an environment that didn't dictate it.
Man, that's interesting. So, and this is coming back from war. And I know obviously you went through, you know, some physical healing, right? You were like pretty beat up.
Yep.
But then when you went out and started a business, what was the first business you started? And I'm curious your benefit of hindsight assessment of how close or unclose the environment was, thus how stressful the post-trauma was.
So the first business I started was a consulting business in creating technical surveillance products, training operatives in using them, and then running operations. So that was literally what I was doing when I left the SEALs. So that very little stress caused in that.
Okay.
I was running real operations with real people with real consequence. Most of the time where we were running operations was less risk. So the stress that I created was in suffering for me. So I was treating operations that were not life and death as if they were life and death. So there are times I remember we were doing an installation for a project. I worked for 36 hours straight. Like that was unnecessary,
right?
In war it was for this. No, I could have taken a break and eaten dinner at some point, right?
Right.
So I was creating stress through suffering in myself by treating an operation of death as life and death. So that would be the stress that I caught.
So Okay. So this is interesting. And obviously I know, I mean, cause we're friends. I know some of your journey of, you know, learning to adapt and I guess the term might be heal.
Yeah.
And thus adapt some of your responses and assumptions and all the things that go into, you know, trauma to be more appropriate to, let's say, a modern business consulting environment. Yeah. But I'm curious, actually, instead of just talking about your experience, I'm curious for people who have not been to war and they have not been in the types of true stress, maybe, I mean, I guess everybody's stress is relative, but you know, they haven't been in those types of situations. Can you give an example of somebody who learned a certain lesson in a certain environment and is now using it to constantly get in their own way in a different environment that you've been able to develop through that and develop different strategies?
Do you want to share yours?
Dude, yeah, I'd have to go unpack our.
I have it. It's right here. So,
yes, absolutely. My audience knows I'm an open book.
Okay.
Now, so, I guess you're going to put that to the test. Let's do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's good example, right? So,
yeah.
Your story is not one of war, right? But it was still, you know, you had traumas that, especially as a child, were big, right? Even though others. No one looking at your traumas in your early life would be like, oh, that's someone who is going to have post-traumatic stress, right? And yet the experiences, your experiences were very much that of someone with post-traumatic stress. So the the words that we use is our traumas create a truth in that environment. As soon as we apply those truths in a new environment, they become untrue.
Right.
When we act in untruth, we create stress in our life. And I believe that, you know, how whatever your belief set is of universe, higher power, consciousness, God, source, whatever you want to say, I believe suffering and stress in our life is a gift from that which is greater than us, pointing us in the right direction, right? So I believe that every time that I am experiencing suffering, I am living in some untruth. And that's a gift from God to point me into a direction of where I no longer have that suffering, mm-hmm. right? which all of a sudden takes me out of being a victim to anything. So in those untruths, we have to find truth, right? What is true in this environment? So yours was, I am a freak and therefore unlovable. That was your core.
Yeah, which was basically born of a lot of bullying as a kid and knowing that I had a genetic disorder that made me feel fundamentally different from exactly. my peers that were bullying.
Yeah, which yeah. for me, it's the autism and Asperger's, right? Like that's where we connected on this. Mm-hmm. I felt the same way. Like I'm a freak. I can't connect with people and the like. Since I cannot be loved, I must overcompensate in every way a man can. So for you, it's like, oh, freak, I'm unlovable. Therefore, I better overcompensate, right? Since I can't be loved, I'm gonna be of significant value. I know these are tricks and they don't really love me. So even when, this is where you create a trap, right?
Yeah.
Even when I create value, oh, see, still not lovable because it's just, they don't know the real me.
Or they only love me because of external things, the things that I can do or the things that I can really that I do for them.
Yeah. And
so it's still not real love.
Yeah. Therefore, I have to keep doing stuff.
Yeah.
Right. So I get to be stuck in that trap. They're going to find out I'll be abandoned, which proves that I'm a freak. And there I'm in the same loop. See, I can make a trap where I get stuck now. That untruth created gifts for you, right? Created unbelievable performance and causes stress, suffering, lack of fulfillment and happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Turning that into the truths, what we got to is that the antidote to that for you, right? What you brought into this world was the truth of me is what drives deep connection with others. It is through these deep connections that I am shown the value that I am. The value that I am proves that I was meant to be.
So I'm so glad that you have that pulled up. Again, this is the output of probably 5 or 6 hours of work that Larry and I did together in one session. But I'll share for me, the revelation, the cathartic shift here is from feeling as a, you know, quote, freak and feeling fundamentally unlovable and literally to the point of feeling almost alien or foreign. And thus that the only way to be accepted was through performance.
Yep.
Which is exhausting.
And limited. Like
and limiting. Yeah, and limiting and largely inauthentic, because like you said, it's a trap where no matter what amount of love you experience, it's not true love because it's not tied to your who you are. Yeah. It's just tied to what you do. And then to eventually arrive at a place where I experience my truth, the essence of me, that which is fundamentally me, not in isolation from others, but through connection with others. And that experience, and you could reread it, but that experience is what awakening to the fact that that experience itself is what makes me fundamentally lovable is that connection. It was the most freeing sensation in the world because I I'll get to the paradoxical upside of it. I no longer had to perform to be loved. I no longer had to perform to even be known. It was simply enough to be known and to allow myself to be loved and to be loved through being known. And what that unlocked for me was now that I'm not doing what I do to prove or to earn anything, I'm able to just do it out of deep joy and love of service. And so what I did then was I stopped proving to myself that no amount of effort would be enough. In other words, I stopped sabotaging my own efforts.
Yeah.
And I've been on an upward ascent ever since.
And you're free. So that's where we go back to the core point, right? For a structurally sound organization, the unresolved traumas of this, the leader, the CEO, the manager are the biggest limitations. Your traumas produce the superpower to create 50 million a year, whatever it was, right?
Right.
And you, at the cost of your experience in life, your suffering and your connection with others, right? Every trauma leads to disconnection, a strategy of disconnection. As soon as we were able to bring that connection back, the company may hit another plateau, but it'll be a structural plateau, not a plateau based on.
Yeah. Which is exactly where I'm at now, where I've spent the last 18 months working on the structural issues to prepare for a breakthrough. But knowing at a deep level, I'm not going to be the constraint anymore.
No.
Yeah.
And you won't, because you don't need to be of value. So at a certain level, you're going to need others to take over what you're doing to bring it to some level. Because at some point, your managerial skill is going to be limited, right? Maybe you grow past it, but you know, maybe it's at $3 billion. I don't know. It might be really big, but at some point, your capability as a manager will limit the growth and you'll be able to step out and get the right person in.
So you said something pretty interesting. You said that, I think, I don't remember exactly your words, but it was essentially that disconnection. We always deal with post-traumatic stress through disconnection. That's always going to be part of the coping.
Disconnection from self. And as soon as we disconnect from self, we disconnect from that which is greater than us. If your belief is God or source or universe, whatever it is, disconnection from that. And through that, disconnection from others. And it all comes from the fact that I believe every perceived trauma that someone has is always at the hands of someone else. So it would make sense that we want separation from others.
Right.
So every trauma, which is a lesson, a strategy that we produce, is always disconnection. And through disconnection, we become limited.
So does it work the other way? In other words, if all trauma results in some level of disconnection, and I'm not being 100% precise with my use of the word, because I'm kind of saying trauma to lump those three things together that you delineated. But if all such trauma leads to disconnection, given that the natural state of human, at least I believe the natural state of human beings is good and loving and connected, you know, and human and not alone.
Yeah.
Do you think that it works in reverse, where you would say all disconnection is at its core stems from trauma?
I think so. right?
Because yeah. that felt right to me.
There's, I've come to, I used to believe that life was suffering. Like that was my core understanding. Like we're here to suffer, and through suffering we can learn. I don't think so. I think that the natural existence of a human, untraumatized, that is ultimately present in the moment, is that of joy, bliss, and fulfillment. And it is through disconnection, lack of presence, and trauma that we introduce suffering into our existence as a human. And that is the arrow back to the truth.
I'll say this, it worked for me. it really did. Even this show itself has been incredibly healing for me. Because it involves
reinforce the learning. Like that's it. Like you're
It involves learning through connection, not learning through suffering for a change.
Totally.
Man, Larry, I this is so good. I time, as always is the case, time with you just flies by. And we're out of it, unfortunately. So I'm curious, how would you sort of, if you're going to wrap this up and put a bow on it as a operation or an actionable takeaway for the audience, for that avatar that we talked about, that frankly, maybe can't, you know, doesn't have either the means or the time, or you probably, I mean, there's only so much Larry to go around. Like they're not going to call you and hire you and come, hey, help fix me so I can grow. How can someone take this and apply this for themselves right now today? And by the way, if you can hire Larry, you should. I will just say that.
I wish there's more Larry to go around. That's for sure. I get that request a lot. I'm going to take it at I want to take this at a very, very actionable level, right? Solving your own trauma is going to be impossible based on the fact that your subconscious relies on it to survive. And therefore will blind you to the truth that you need to be free. That was a very dense statement, so you should probably rewind and listen to that again. What I'm basically saying is you can't solve your own trauma in isolation. It's not possible.
Your mind won't let you unlearn a lesson that it thinks is keeping you alive.
Basically. You got it.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So on that piece, I'm not even going to try and get you into like, here's steps to do it. What I will say, and I think of the place to like sit in, is if you could just start bringing into your experience that anywhere I'm experiencing suffering, struggle, strife, whatever you want to call it, right? When I'm experiencing that, know that that is not meant for you. Like that's not your natural state. And know that that's always coming from some disconnection, somewhere that I'm creating distance in my life. You're going to start being able to identify where you can start taking some action. That's something I think everyone could do on a regular basis. Is it disconnection from self, meaning I'm not in my truth? Right? Is it disconnection from that which is greater than me, where I'm isolated and alone? Is it disconnection with those around me?
Right.
Where am I creating disconnection for safety, enabling suffering?
So let me ask one follow-up clarification question. If are you okay on time? I know we're technically
yeah, I'm good.
Okay. So follow-up clarification question. I think that spiritual disconnection, maybe it's hard to define, but I think people know it when they feel it. Certainly disconnection from others, fractured relationships, discord, contention, whatever, disharmony. I feel like disconnection from self is one of those terms that, depending on how much time people have spent in worlds where people use those terms, it might sound a little woo-woo or a little just opaque.
Yeah.
Can you describe, experientially, maybe some examples, like what does disconnection from self look like in people's typical life?
So, you know me in that my superpower is language, right? Leveraging language is what I do.
And which I want to weave that in. The way you teach teams to coordinate action, the largest tool you teach is about using language to create alignment and movement, right?
And so what the easiest way to identify disconnection from self, I would say, or separation from self, is going to be a language pattern. The language pattern you got to look for is absolutes. So anytime that you are thinking in or actually saying absolutes, you're creating disconnection.
Black and white language, yeah. Basically.
My life sucks. I never get a good deal.
Yeah.
Right.
Always, never. Maybe like errors of error. I mean, I'm thinking of Seligman's 3 P's of pessimism, right? Errors of size, errors of time, and errors of blame.
Yeah.
I blame myself, or I make it bigger than it is, or I make it longer than it is.
Yep. So I would say, if I was this, like, something we can do in these couple minutes, like, what could you start paying attention to be able to identify when you're creating disconnection internally? It's absolutes.
And by the way, oh my gosh, this is so cool. I think we might've just closed a circle. Isn't it true that one of the fallacies of the traumatic lessons we learn is because the brain uses them as a survival mechanism, it essentially frames them as absolutes.
It
can't take the chance of allowing for exceptions.
Yeah. Notice my untruths, right? Everything's going to go to shit. Everything.
Right.
Everyone I care about is going to be injured or killed. It's all my fault. Yours. I am a freak and therefore unlovable.
Yeah.
Since I cannot be loved, I must overcompensate in every way someone can.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So every time it's these, you're taking a position. When I'm working with someone on, all I'm doing is asking them questions and hearing where they plant a flag. As soon as they plant a flag, I know, oh, there's my entry point.
Because all life and all truth is really a gray area. And if you start talking about it like it isn't, you're probably been traumatized there.
Listen to the truth, right? So I am a freak and therefore unlovable, right? The inverse to that, the truth of me is what drives deep connection with others. There's no absolutes there.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's just a very active moment-to-moment statement.
Yet it is absolutely true. That's absolutely true. That's as true for me as it is to you, right? That's true to everyone on this call. The truth of who you are is what drives the deep connection with those around you. That is absolutely true. That's why I know, like, there is something greater than us, that your individual trauma produces a individual strategy. I'm a freak and therefore unlovable, but uncovers an absolute truth for every human. The truth of me is what drives deep connection with others.
Yeah. That's so cool. You say that. I remember from our experience, you know, we've done some work together in group environments and you had stated this as kind of a postulate and it proved out in the group environment that all untruths, i.e. extrapolated lessons from trauma, are very individuated. They're very unique to me, but all the true truths,
the healing or the antidote, the medicine for your trauma.
Those are all almost, they're actually almost banalities. They're almost like generalizations because they're actually statements that are true for everyone. True truth is universal. False truth is individual.
You got it.
It's so cool. Dude, so good to reconnect, man.
I agree, man.
Okay, how can the world go get more from Larry? Please share.
I launched a book about a couple months ago, How Leadership Actually Works. So that's right now probably the best way is through that. So howleadershipactuallyworks.com is the book website. That's probably the easiest place. And that connects to SEAL Team Leaders is our company. So you'd be able to find us there as well.
Larry, I'm going to confess, I haven't read your book. Is there an audiobook version?
There is.
Do you read it?
I did not, or you would sleep. I have no, in my inflection is not my, my tonal quality would put people to sleep. I hired a voice actor that actually made me want to listen to the book again.
That's probably a good sign. Cool. No, I'm going to download it. I use Apple iBooks, but okay. I'm looking at the website. Yeah. It's a great looking site.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening. And especially if you like or share or leave a review, thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.